Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm joined today by Dr. Tricia Smith, our Director of Clinical Services, and Brett Durbin, one of our chaplains here at the clinic. And today our topic is the war for your attention, how the battle for focus is a battle for your soul. You guys see much attention problems? And I guess we could talk about attention in general, and I don't know if you want to. We can also talk about, you know, a disorder of attention, attention deficit disorder, attention deficit hyperactivity technically disorder is what it's called. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But do we see problems of attention?
Yeah, I mean, I think just we're inundated with information at all times now. You know, I mean, so whether it's our phones or it's, you know, TV or it's our job or it's, you know, whatever it is that's going around in society in general, there's just so much going on. And it's, I think a lot of it's just information overload. So yeah, I mean, to whatever is pulling your attention, you know, and if it's being pulled in 9 different directions, are you really doing anything, is anything focused? And so are people able to focus, you know, and I have 7 kids, you know, and so I'm watching these different phases and even just different time periods where they're being raised. And now with more technology and everything else, how much is that pulling their attention? And, you know, I'm concerned as a parent, you know, just looking at maybe how much screen time they get. And is that going to actually have an effect on their brain, which the two of you could speak to a lot more than I could, you know?
Yeah. So let's talk about actual attention. Yeah. What do we pay attention to? And if the questions come up later and we want to talk about a disorder of attention, we can. But I don't think that's where our focus is, the disorder of attention. It is attention. What are we paying attention to? And you're right. It makes a difference. And there is a battle for the soul going on. What are we paying attention to? And you mentioned as a dad, you've got a lot of distractions. What are the things that are distracting your kids? And you're a mom. What are the things distracting the kids? And do you see their things competing for their attention?
Oh, absolutely. I think the big thing these days are screen time. You know, what are they watching on TV? What messages are they getting? What messages are they getting on their devices, whether it's their handheld games, whether it's their phones? What are they listening to? What are they bringing into themselves? And how much they can actually sit down and focus and do those things. It's the instant gratification that they're getting from these video games or from TVs. You know, even the amount of TV shows used to be, you know, a half an hour long. Now they're like getting shorter for the kids. They're getting like 20 minutes long with little commercials in between because it's like all these little clip-its. All YouTube is just like quick clip-its of all this information that is coming in or these little videos. And so it's how they're, in this day and age, they're absorbing so much so fast and it has to be so quick. Otherwise, their attention is not there.
Yeah, but what are they absorbing in those types of clips? Seriously, those what you just described neurobiologically is designed to create a emotional reaction of some kind, a wow, oh, that was cool, that's exciting, oh, that's interesting, but with very little actual contemplation, very little reasoning, very little reflection. Which these are the higher cortical functions where you actually pay attention and focus, where you have to stay with something for a while to go into the deeper levels. This is designed to give very superficial reactionary responses, and anything that requires you to go, it's like, that's hard, that's so much work, I can't, and they move on. So these types of what you've described neurobiologically undermine capacity for attention is what will happen, the more of that they do. So, you know, parents, what do parents do to help protect the developing brain so that these higher cortical circuits will develop? You know, when I got married, my wife had a 13-year-old son from her first marriage, became my stepson, and I did not try to become his dad. I let him know that he has his dad, and I want that relationship with his dad to be strong and super. That's his dad. I'm not going to be his dad. But in my home, I am the head of the home. So when he comes to my home, I'm still the head of this house. And in my house, and of course, his mother and I conversed about what the structure would be. So we're always, of course, parental unit one, and that was very healthy. And so we had to decide, and how are we going to navigate his screen time? how, because I knew neurobiologically what would be happening. And so this is just my intervention that we did with him, and it worked beautifully, is that he had to keep his, we had to have an actual written log. I gave him a log. And actual hours in school and hours in church were neutral time, didn't count. But everything else was considered free time. And free time, he had the log. And it didn't matter what he was doing that wasn't screen time. He could be playing the Monopoly board game with his friends. He could be outside playing basketball. He could be, you know, doing any active other activity of all. And he logged it. He had to earn 2 hours of non-screen time to earn 1 hour of screen time. And I understood I'm requiring him to exercise his neural circuits in other ways than just stimulating with screen time. And he had to do that all the way up through the time he left the house. And it was very protective for him. And, you know, he ended up doing great and successful and all. And maybe it's because of just who he was. But I like to think that this helped his brain to do something like this. But what other things have you found that parents can do to help their kids in their attention? And notice what I did was I didn't say you had to pay attention to, you have to do 2 hours of Bible study. No, I knew anything other than screen time, he would be organizing, planning, cerebellar activity for coordination of motor movement, which when you do physical play like baseball and coordinating the hitting of the ball, the circuits of your brain that require you to move your physical body in coordinated ways also help you coordinate your thinking patterns later in life. And so I wanted to develop all those circuits for him.
Absolutely. I mean, we limit screen time at our house. So, I mean, we'll do half an hour in the morning. If it's a Saturday morning, they're waking up slowly. Okay, now get up, go play, turn off the screens, go do something. Well, we're bored. What do we do? I'm not going to tell you what to do. Go outside. It's a beautiful day. You got lots of things to play with. You know, I'm trying to give them that autonomy where that creativity comes in for themselves. And my husband will be like, it's good to be bored. You can be bored. That's a good thing. You should be comfortable with getting bored. I was bored a lot as a kid.
Right, right. You're right. Parents don't want to be entertainment directors.
No.
Because we want them to use their creativity. That's another neurocognitive process. Imagination, creativity, initiation, okay? Rather than looking to be entertained by someone else all the time. If you do that as parents, even without the screen time, then you're actually conditioning your kids to grow up to be a lemming, to have somebody else tell them how to live their life.
Yeah.
Okay.
To be controlling.
Yes.
Yes. And then them not have the autonomy that it is their life and their childhood.
Yes. And there's plenty. So parents set a big structure. You can do this within these bounds, but go and you can't go, you know, down to the gas station and hang out on the corner, mm-hmm. but in the yard, do whatever you want.
Yeah. We give our kids watches and we say, be back in half an hour. You can peruse the neighborhood, go to your friend's house, go play basketball, go play baseball, but just be back in half an hour for dinner. And they're like, yeah, we'll go out. Yeah. Their little bikes.
Well, and I think it's almost, there's a flip side too of the whole, you know, you don't want to be their entertainment director. And that also leads to more screen time because it's just much easier. It's like, okay, fine, do what you want, you know. And
unless you limit the screen time.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, and I get that, you know, but a lot of times that's the easy play, which, again, it may not be the right play, but it's the easy play. I think that's how it happens a lot.
Yeah, how many times are you at a restaurant and you're seeing a whole family on devices?
On screens, yeah.
So, but in the home, do you have other things easily accessible to them besides screens?
Oh, sure, yeah.
I mean, that would be the thing. For instance, mm-hmm. Whether it's Legos, whether it is art, books, and paintings, and just the types of things they can do with their hands, crafts and things. They may not want to do them, but you have those things available. And then I know when I grew up, we ended up actually playing with, believe it or not, we went outside and played games with cans, mm-hmm. Kick the can and this kind of stuff because, you know, we didn't have a lot of stuff. I mean, we would make stuff up to play. You'd draw lines in the sand with a rock. Who can throw the rock closest to the line? And, mm-hmm.
Yeah, this brings up a question. This is because I'm sitting here with you guys, and I think this would be something you could answer. But there's also something to me, and this is more just my own observation and opinion on this. But when I look at, say, all of our family comes together and we watch something together, we watch a movie night, or we do something like that, feels so different than when all the kids break off into their own little corner with their iPad or their phone or their own TV or whatever it is. You know, that feels different to me. And it feels like that even that screen time is different, in my opinion, but I don't even know why. And maybe it's just the togetherness, that it's a group activity. Yes, there's a screen on, but we're doing it as a group. Is there any validity in that, or am I kidding myself?
What do you mean feels different in what way?
So it's a shared experience.
Yeah.
It's being done as a family.
Yeah, it's a family shared experience.
As a family.
Yeah.
And then you guys also get to talk about that experience moving forward. Talk about the movie.
Yeah.
Right. So you can.
And they're not just. I feel like there's almost a zombie feel where.
There's isolation in that.
Yeah.
Right. So you can. If you did it as a family, you can even weeks later say, you remember that movie we watched?
Yeah.
And you can bring it up and reference it in something. Yeah. So it becomes part of a, I think we say, shared experience. Mm-hmm. For the family, that doesn't necessarily mean the screen time was healthy for the brain.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Yeah.
No, I mean, entertainment, depends on what you were watching. You might have been watching a sermon. You might have been watching an education video to teach them how to do something as a family. But if you're watching just like entertainment movies, those entertainment movies are activating emotion circuits while suspending activity in your critical reasoning circuits. And the multiple studies show that the more of that you watch, the less developed your prefrontal cortex. And thus, kids growing up on a lot of entertainment video have overdeveloped emotion circuits and underdeveloped critical reasoning restraint circuits. And then when they hit adolescence and the hormones hit, they're more moody, they're more irritable, they're more likely to act out aggressively and or sexually, turn to substances to calm themselves because they don't have a prefrontal cortex that is capable of processing the emotions that are actually more intense than they would have been had they not been watching so much television. And their prefrontal cortex can't process and calm the way it would have been had they not been watching so much television. And so this is not even about the content. This will happen on G-rated programming. G-rated programming, it actually changes. And this is the law of exertion. If you want something to get stronger, you must exercise it. If you don't use it, you lose it. But if you exercise it, it gets stronger. Theatrical programming exercises emotion circuits while suspending reasoning circuits and thinking circuits. And if you doubt me on that, anybody, next time you watch your favorite theatrical programming, engage thinking. Actually reason through critically what you're watching. How reasonable is this? Is this likely to happen? What does that mean that this just happened? And you won't be able to watch your show more than a few minutes before you go, this is really stupid. And I've done this with people. I start pointing this out, and they get irritated with me, and they'll actually say, you're not supposed to think about it. Yes, I know. In order to be entertained, you don't want to think. And it suspends activity here.
Dr. J ruined my favorite show.
No, I've done this. I've done this with people. I mean, most of the crime shows that you watch, if you actually think about anything you're seeing there, they all have major gaps that are stupid if you watch them, of various kinds. The perp that you've been after because they have some biological weapon that could wipe out the whole city, and then you finally spot him across a five lanes of city traffic over there, and you shout to him to freeze until you get over there so you can have a big chase scene. You don't just walk up and put the bag on him. Or you see your friendly, jolly cop who is, 100 pounds overweight that you love, great personality, and he, a 17-year-old drug dealer on the street, they end up in a chase for 2.5 miles up and down 7 stories, and he's right behind him the whole way. Oh, come on. He couldn't go 3 steps and catch that guy.
No.
You've seen this though in the movies, right?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And if you think about it, you go, that's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or the chase scene where they come around a corner and, as he comes to the corner, he's, 50 yards behind him. When they come around the corner, he's like 5 feet behind him. And so there's very, very, very little programming I can watch, because I can't help myself from seeing these things. It's hard to turn off. But even if you can, it's still damaging to you. And I'll give you an example, and for our audience as well, and what happens to attention. And so again, suspending, so we're talking about attention today. This type of entertainment teaches you to suspend your thinking unless you're having something very emotionally attention-grabbing that keeps you focused. So if it's not emotionally gripping, like your history book, I can't focus on this, because you're being conditioned to have your attention on this thing that requires no actual willpower or a focus of your attention. It draws you there. In fact, you almost have to discipline yourself to look away because it grabs your attention. But it's also neurobiologically damaging. Most people, adults that I know, have seen the movie Saving Private Ryan. Do you remember the opening beach scene on Normandy?
Yes.
What do you think we would have found if the first time you watched it, we were monitoring your heart rate, blood pressure, and stress hormone, cortisol levels? Many people who in the opening beach scene were watching that, if they were eating popcorn, they had to put it down. It couldn't keep eating. Some got nauseated, vomited, and left. What's happening? There is a neurobiological, your brain is not telling the difference between you being in it. And so your body is responding. Your cortisol levels are going up. Your heart rate levels are going up. Your blood pressure levels are going up. You're having a vasovagal, you're losing your appetite. You're getting queasy on your stomach. You're getting frightened. You're getting anxious. And you know what? They call this is great entertainment. Because that's the goal of theatrical programming. Theatrical programming's goal is to get an emotional response out of you. And the stronger the response, the better. But it's actually, your body just paid a price for that. And that actually is actually more of that you do. It's toxic to your brain. Okay? And then over the time affects attention. So where we spend attention, we've talked about entertainment, kids, devices. And young men need to be protected. Seriously, the porn problem. I don't think young men have any capacity to resist on their own.
Oh yeah. No, I mean
the prefrontal cortex is not developed. It's all limbic driven.
Yeah, when I was pastoring, and this was, I mean, gosh, it was in the mid-2000s, you know, around 2006 or 7. And we did something called Porn Sunday. And it was basically, we kind of would break up the guys and the girls. And we had a couple hundred, you know, young adult men come to this. And, you know, I had them stand up if they've ever looked at porn on their phone. And the entire room did. There was two guys that almost didn't. And then they went ahead and got up. But it was 100% of the room did. And so, I mean, that told you right there. Like, this is significant. This isn't just a small issue.
No.
And like you said, I think there's a truth to that where there can't. Do we have the ability to, especially at that age?
No, they don't.
To withhold and not do that. At least a peak. You know.
It's like, no. When once they know it's there and accessible, and they will know because of all their friends, they will know. If they didn't know about it, then of course you. But once they know it's accessible, this is a limbic drive that hits at adolescence. And the prefrontal cortex that restrains that doesn't finish developing until you're 25. And so that self-restraint is just not there. And then once you start gratifying that, it is the reward circuits are too strong. And this is the whole goal of these things. And this is a demonic influence, in my view, to actually destroy and then bring huge guilt and shame and then corrupt identity and relationships. And so young men need parents to set a line with them. In whatever it is, you want your son to have a phone? Great, get him a flip phone.
Yeah,
get him a. You cannot have a phone like this until you're 18, 19, 20, whatever. Or you know, once you're 18, if you pay for it yourself, I guess you can get one. But we're not giving you one. We're not putting that in your hand. Now I haven't kept up with it because I don't have a need because I don't have a child at this age. I would be totally supportive if there were systems in place that were not hackable and getting aroundable that would just completely protect them, and then I wouldn't have an obstacle to that. But I don't know if those systems are actually truly functional, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. It takes multiple lines to make it work, I think.
Yeah. And I think there's some accountability programs that help with protection on devices and computers and things of that nature. So, I mean, even at 18 or 19, if I'm the parent and that is my phone and I'm paying for it, it's going to have accountability programs all over it.
Yep. No, because again, this is a biological drive, and what grabs attention? The things that grabs attention are the things that are most exciting and rewarding. And it's a godly design that a husband is absolutely excited and his attention is drawn to his beautiful wife. Okay? That it's supposed to be. And then when it happens as God designed, there'll be a bonding experience in the sexual intimacy when oxytocin is released in a love relationship and neurobiology changes. And you actually create a bond, neurobiologic, where when you wait and have that experience, that person, you have a greater love for, connection for, attraction for, and others in the community lose, they dim into the background once you've had, if you've actually waited. However, if you have a life history of a lot of sexual promiscuity and pornography, you actually damage those bonding circuits. And there needs to be a detox period of celibacy and letting your brain clear before you actually get in a relationship so that you can have a healthy bonding experience. If you don't, then what happens is you get in relationships and you don't have that sense of intimacy that you should have and that commitment. And then you still have a wandering eye going everywhere.
How do you guys see just the how much distraction affects our emotional health? Is there a strong connection to that? If we're easily distracted, does it make us, emotionally, are we less stable?
Well, I will say that, it plays out in relationship. If you're trying to have time with your friend and your friend is constantly picking up their phone, or you're trying to have a serious conversation with your wife and your wife is constantly picking up your phone, you don't feel connected. You don't feel heard. You don't feel seen. That relationship and that depth of that isn't there because that distraction is there. Oh, I just need to send this text to work, or I just need to let this go to whoever. Well, are you in this moment with me?
Yeah.
It's impacting.
It comes across as disrespectful too,
So Dr. Smith is identifying an element of the relationship is, do you give the person you're communicating, engage with, your attention? And so, that, again, at this moment, we're just talking about, do you prioritize them over the other things that are important to you? If that's not happening, then you can ask the question, why? Why is that not happening? And is it not happening because of a biological attention problem? Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and people just can't stay attentive to where they want. Is it not happening because there's something else very urgent in their life at that moment? Like if you were, either one of you right now were trying to pay attention to what we're doing and knowing that, you're waiting word for a loved one's coming out of a surgery. Okay, and you're going to be looking at your phone. Does that word come yet? Or you're waiting word on the approval of whether your mortgage got approved so you can get the house you want. Okay, that something's real important to you might be. You're important, but it's an urgency, certain thing. But you're right. It doesn't really matter the reason. If it's happening, it undermines that sense of connection. And then we can inquire, why is it happening? What are the kinds of things that interfere with attention? One, heart attitude, what we're valuing in the moment. Do we really care about the person or not?
Priorities,
yeah. Mm-hmm. And let's all face it, we've all had those moments in the church lobby or somewhere where a particular person who is, we've had experience with, is going to come up with their latest little distraction and what your history tells you is noise of non-substance. We've all had these individuals, and it's very hard to stay attentive to them. It's like, your mind is like, how can I get out of here? Right?
Yeah.
Okay. But those sometimes are very objectively driven. There are people that just waste our time.
Mm-hmm.
Then there are the situations where you're actually involved in something that's invaluable to you. Your team is in the Super Bowl and you're watching the game and your spouse comes to have a conversation. That's not a good time to have that conversation. You're not going to get full attention. And if you do, it's going to be resentful attention.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a dilemma.
Yeah. So there's a wisdom question. Are you?
When's the right time to have that conversation?
Yeah.
It's definitely not late at night. Right. Where you both are tired and can't focus. It's definitely not when the two of you are hungry, because if you're hungry, you don't want to talk to me. Those type of basic needs also need to be met if you're talking about connection and attention and focus.
No, this is another important one biologically. Late at night, also though, sleep deprived. So it might be in the morning, but you were a third shift worker, or you were
a doctor who was wakened in the night multiple times for emergencies because you're on call. And so it's the morning, but you didn't get good sleep. So if you're, whatever the reason, if you're sleep deprived or it's late at night, prefrontal cortex is not optimal. And so you're going to be distractible. You're going to be irritable. You're going to not have the same level of patience. And so, yes, there are physiological elements there that play in. Exactly right.
How about this thought of, I am better when I'm multitasking?
I have heard people say this. I've never, ever given an example where that's true. You're not better when you're multitasking. What do you mean? Tell me what you mean by that. What they actually mean, I mean, I don't know. Do you have an example what they mean by that? You mean
more production? Is that what they're getting at?
Yeah.
Yeah, I can handle juggling three different things at
okay,
once.
Okay, so more. I say, really? Okay. Let's test that. Here's two computers, and I want you to balance a spreadsheet here while you write a document over here at the same time. Can you do that for me? Because you're better when you're doing two things at once. Nah, this is ridiculous.
Can you actually do two things at once?
Well, can you walk and chew gum?
Yeah.
As the old saying goes, can you walk
with
and chew
focus,
gum?
I guess, okay. Is what I'm saying.
So,
since we're talking about focus.
So what I think they mean is they actually don't mean what they say, and you have to clarify that. What I think they sometimes mean is that if their fingers are fidgeting while they're focused over here and their fingers are doing this, okay, they have a spinner or they have a fidgeter or whatever. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They may mean something like, well, that actually is not taking away their focus. That's something they're doing without focus, actually. But if they mean I can focus better if I have my music on. Excuse me, I can do better. I can listen to my music and do that. Well, what's the music doing? Because I actually have, when I travel, I have a headphones and I have a actual music lineup that I actually call study music. And I put my headphones on and this music plays so that I can tune out all the other noise that is distracting, so that I can focus while I'm sitting in the airport lobby or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so if they have a music lineup that is actually music that they have conditioned their auditory circuits as this is background music that doesn't distract me, that may very well may be true. But if they mean they can watch TV while they study their history book at the same, they can't. This is a lie. They will not do as well. So you have to clarify what they actually mean by that.
Well, I think it's a fallacy. I don't think that our full attention is on that one project, that one thing that you are focused on. If you've got several different projects open and you're working on it, or you're attending a virtual meeting and you're still working on a project or doing notes or things of that nature, I don't think that you are fully giving your full attention. And I think you're missing stuff.
Well, 100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah. No, you can't do your best by multitasking. So I would have to have that process with them and say, what is this doing for you? Why is this important?
Yeah. And what are you putting off to that person as well? I mean, I think just back to the relationship thing. I mean, it drives me crazy when I'm meeting with someone and they're doing two or three other things. You can tell they're looking at an email or they're responding to something. And it's just, you know, it is just it's a thing, you know, and it does show you that your conversation is not what's, you know, front and center right now, which I get it. There's times that happens, but if it's just continual, you know, it's like, well, we're kind of in a conversation right now, but not really.
Focus and attention is a critical cognitive ability that people need to be able to marshal. And it is not something that is necessarily innate. It's like any other ability. It gets better with use. It is helpful. Now, traditional school would have put people in a position to develop the skill. Study hour, sit at your desk, read your assignment, come home, parents, sit down, do your math, okay? And you would have to not only focus and attend to do the work, and you can't go play until all those 10 problems are done, that type thing. Traditional schoolwork was an application of attention and focus. I don't know what school's like today. I don't have any young kids. I don't know if they still do that or not. A lot of it's on pads these days, and it's more digital. Does it require attention and focus? Is it more, you know, reactionary and interactive rather than actually you reading and you working problems that requires that attention and focus? But it's this is critically important to develop this capacity and to and not only just the attention to focus, but also to restrain the impulse and the imagination that I'm actually thinking about my math problems or my history assignment, and I'm not in my mind out playing with my friends and doing all the imaginary stuff I want to do. And it, and you just can't get that skill without application. And so, you know, you guys have kids today. Do you say, no, I can see in their life we have these structured times and they're actually applying this and they're developing this.
Yeah. I mean, first thing we do when I get home with our kids is they have to do their homework before they can do anything else. So we get a snack, we sit down, do their homework, and then after the homework is done, then they're able to go out and have fun.
Yeah, ours are homeschooled, so it's a little bit different.
Well, then they're probably getting application time to study and focus.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Quiet time, sit, read something, take 15 minutes, read, and then each give a this would be something if I was homeschooling, there would be some section of reading and then standing up and giving a report.
Mm-hmm.
Reading and giving a report on what you read. That would be developing so many skills: attention, focus, concentration, comprehension, processing, verbal expression, presentation. In other words, there's so many skills in that little assignment, regardless of what the topic. They can be reading a book on Bugs Bunny. It really doesn't matter. That it's not about so much the subject matter. It is that skill of comprehension, reading, integrating, developing your own language skills, your own verbal presentation skills, and then you give that public speaking feedback. They didn't do this for us when we were in school, but it would be a great skill to help, and it requires so much of the higher cortical functions.
Is there, say you're someone who has had a lot of screen time or has had a lot of distraction, a lot of this time, is there a way to detox yourself from it and repair, or is this something that's permanent damage to your brain? Because I'm sure that's what a lot of people that would be watching may be in that position where, man, I've spent a lot of time doing this. You know, is there a way to rebuild myself so my attention can be, I can have more focus and I can, you know, repair maybe some of the damage?
Your brain is in a constant state of flux unless you're dead. Okay. If you're alive, then doing healthy things results in healthy outcomes. And so if you disengage behaviors that are, overactivating your emotion circuits and underactivating your prefrontal cortex, and you start engaging the prefrontal cortex, yes, you will actually develop the calming, the reasoning, the self-restraint circuits, and you will slowly prune back the emotional reactivity over time. This will happen. When Albert Einstein died, they biopsied his brain, and he had less neurons per cubic centimeter of brain tissue than the average person. But he had significantly more neuron-to-neuron connections than the average person. And it's the neuron-to-neuron connections that make networks for information processing. And we are not born with those significant connections. They develop based on application or exercise of the circuit. He spent tens of thousands of more hours contemplating deep problems that required his brain to expand and make networks for contemplation. We would have found the same thing, and that would have been Einstein's prefrontal cortex, where you have this higher critical reasoning going on. But if we could have biopsied Mozart's auditory, musical, fine motor skill processing circuits, you'd find the same thing in his. Because if you exercise those circuits, they actually build bigger and more complex networks. And if you stop using them, they prune back and you lose those. And so this type of programming develops those emotion circuits without the complex higher cortical functions to process them in an effective way. And you get a lot of immature acting out and or chemically altered individuals that are using that to self-medicate. So yes, if you detox, cut back the theatrical programming and start engaging in things that require you to pay attention, think, reason, problem solve. One of the best things, seriously, best things, is intelligent Bible study, an actual studying the Bible. And what I mean by studying the Bible is not just reading the story superficially and learning that David slew Goliath. And the Goliath was a Philistine, and it happened in this year of David's life. This is just kind of learning historical facts. There's not much development that goes on with that. healthy Bible study is actually reading the Bible and trying to understand the meaning and the deeper spiritual applications of what the larger landscape of the of what's going on in the human race and this battle between Christ and Satan, and how these stories have some application to our life today in the deeper motivations of the heart. That requires a lot of deep reflection and contemplation. And it really, and if you're doing it in a prayerful, humble attitude with the Lord, you're connecting with the divine presence, which will accelerate that development. And nothing is better for brain development than really good, healthy Bible study that seeks to understand the meaning behind the words, not just the words. So things that then contribute to attention problems. Now, I guess we ought to talk a little about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That is the official nomenclature of it today. It used to be called attention deficit disorder. It's now called attention deficit hyperactivity disorder with three subtypes: the inattentive type, the hyperactive type, and the combined type, where you have both. And if you actually have this disorder, this is neurobiologically driven, meaning there's something going on in the neural circuitry of the brain that interferes with the normal processes of attention, focus, and self-restraint. So there's impulse control problems and or distractibility and focus problems. I say if you actually have it, because you can have the symptoms, the exact symptoms of ADHD without having ADHD. Anything that impairs the prefrontal cortex from doing its normal work will be a mimicker of ADHD. So significant chronic sleep deprivation, or somebody with untreated sleep apnea who never gets deep sleep, they're in and out of light stage sleep, will look like ADHD, a little bit distractive and moody and impulsive and so forth. And so you want to identify that's what we're actually dealing with. A significant head injury, a TBI person with a serious head injury can actually have attention deficit symptoms that come on later in life. They never had them, and they have them permanently now because they have had a serious TBI. That would not be ADHD. We would call that a cognitive disorder from a head injury that looks like ADHD. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. But anything that interferes with prefrontal cortex function, somebody who's intoxicated will be distractible, non-focused, because the prefrontal cortex is impaired. So when anybody has this this ADHD symptomology, it's really important to qualify: is this actually a biologically driven process? That's been there lifelong from childhood, or is this some other mimicker? They've actually, when some individuals also identify certain allergens that people can have, that when you remove those, that those allergens are affecting CNS function, and you remove those, and then their cognition and attention improves. So there's mimickers out there. ADHD, though, if a child actually has it, they all don't manifest in the same way. Some can have just the inattentive type. Typically, the hyperactives get identified because they can't stay in their seat. They're fidgety. They're impulsive. They're disrupting the class. They're blurting things out. And so they typically come to attention in classes and typically get treated. But the inattentive ones that don't have the hyperactive stuff, who just sit quietly and daydream and don't pay attention, they just get kind of bad grades, and they don't often get identified. Conversely, the inattentive ones with high IQ, and you can have high IQ and have an attention problem, they often don't get identified actually until college. And the way to conceptualize this would be, if you think about an internet connection and bandwidth, some of you, I don't know if you're old enough, but I remember when we had dial-up internet connections, where you had to use the telephone to dial-up internet connections. These are very, very low bandwidth. Okay. Or if you have a really bad internet connection today, it takes a long time to download a movie. High internet bandwidth, you can download a movie in just a minute, really quick. People with high IQ have high bandwidth. They may not pay attention long, but in that minute, they can download a whole movie. Average IQ, they may need an hour to download that movie. They can still get the same information and still show the same show, get the same performance, but they have to stay online longer. So average IQ, low IQ with attention comes to you identify them sooner in their education because they start falling behind. High IQ will often graduate high school. They'll be in college before they first start being overwhelmed. And they're overwhelmed because now they can't pay attention for just a couple of minutes and assimilate enough to actually pass. They have to actually pay attention to these ideas are much more complex, and they've never developed that ability. And so they fall behind. And then you know what their symptoms are? Their symptoms are anxiety. They actually go to the doctor complaining of worry and anxiety, and because they don't want to fail, they're falling behind, and they feel like they're drowning, and they can't get their head above water, and there's too much going on. And so the anxiety that you get when you feel like there's so much going on and you're drowning and everything, that they come with this type of anxiety, and they will often get put on a class of medicines called serotonin reuptake inhibitors like Prozac and Paxil and Zoloft and these types of meds. And those types of medicines actually interfere with the very neurotransmitters they don't have enough of, so it makes their problems worse. And they will usually get worse. And so if that's the case, if you put them on the proper meds, then suddenly their anxiety resolves because now they're able to pay attention. They're not falling behind. They can get things done. Okay. And then they still need to develop organizational skills that they never developed, but they can stay online or stay focused long enough to develop those skills.
Okay. That was wild. You just like told my story. Like there was, I had that where it didn't really present itself until I was running an organization on my own and I couldn't compartmentalize everything. And it was overwhelming to a point where it felt like depression or anxiety or something else. They did try that. It was not a good reaction. But then they tried something that was in the proper type of medication. It was absolutely game changing, you know, and it really did fix the problem, but you just described exactly that. So, yeah.
So why it is important for parents, if you have a child with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, you want to be sure they get a good diagnosis, not just symptoms. You actually want to rule out the mimickers, but you want to treat them. Why you want to treat them? Here's why. Because it goes to their developing identity. I'm going to give you a mock-up imitation of what it might be like to be inside the mind of a third or fourth or fifth grader who's got ADHD, who's not treated, and then the impact it has on their developing self if you don't treat them. This is what will happen to your child. So the child's in class and the teacher's talking about the capitals of Europe. And the capital of France is, wow, that's a cool bird. Wow, I don't know if we have a bird like that at our home. I'm going to ask mom about that when I get home. And the capital of Italy is, Johnny's got a new pen. I'd like a pen like that. And the capital of Amy's passing a note. Hope the teacher doesn't see that. She'll get in trouble. Okay, and this is how it goes through the class. And then the teacher says, okay, now, calls on the student. What was the capital of France? And they either don't know or they make something up and everybody laughs at them. And then what happens? I'm stupid. I'm not smart. I'm not a good student. I better not go to college. I'll fail. And so their sense of self is being distorted with insecurity, lack of confidence. They won't actually try certain things. Now, if they happen to be maybe skillful in the athletic side or something outside of the classroom, they may really invest strong there. But they won't actually apply their intelligence to its full capacity because they're learning from experience that they're bad at this. And they get laughed at and they're dumb. When in fact, it is they have a mind that can't stay on and can't focus, can't pay attention. And so it would be very much like somebody who has very bad nearsightedness and they've never had their eyes examined and sit in the back of the room. The teacher's marking on the marker board and ask them to read what's on the board and it's all blurry. They can't see it. And so they just say something, everybody laughs at them. They don't have an IQ problem. You've got a focus, vision problem. And so untreated ADHD have a mind that can't focus. And that is the problem. And if you give the child glasses, they can see. If you give the child the proper treatment, they can focus and pay attention. And it changes not just their moment-to-moment performance, it changes their developing self where they can develop a greater sense of confidence and appreciation in their abilities. So I think it's a huge thing that parents, be sensitive to this. Be careful to knock out the mimickers. So we're not treating things we don't need to treat. But if they actually have this problem, it's better to treat it than not treat it.
Do you feel that it does seem like it's very prevalent now. Do you feel like that is it's reality because of maybe all of the technology overload, all those
things? So then there's the developmental one. Okay. What they're seeing a lot of, I think, is I was going to say, but I'm not going to say bad parenting. Okay. basically what you said earlier, parents using the devices to entertain the kids. And the kids growing up with this type of, when I already told you what this theatrical entertainment does to the brain, These kids wouldn't have a genetic neurobiological ADHD had they not had so much theatrical programming that they their brain grew on. But we have much more of it now because these devices are developing brains in ways that do not require the engagement of those prefrontal circuit cortex. So, and multiple studies have shown this. The more of theatrical entertainment, G-rated entertainment programming, the higher the attention problems that you have. So there's a developmental aspect that will be diagnosed as traditional ADHD because it is in the young years and it is the first thing they're seeing in the in that right age range for diagnosis. But it's not necessarily coming out of the genetics. Genetically, they wouldn't have had it had they didn't had they had different environmental experiences.
Does it cause it though? In other words, is it more of is it mimicking it or does it does that person then permanently have
ADHD? So that's a good question. What I just described does cause ADHD. You have a brain that is now not functional in the way that it would have otherwise been. It did not come because there was a gene defect with neurotransmitter deficiencies. It came because neural circuitry did not develop in the proper way for this to be this capacity to be realized. Then if you remove that and begin engaging in healthy ways, the brain can recover, and then you may outgrow the attention deficit capacities. However, if it's not treated and they continue to engage in the same behaviors that were driving this, in other words, they continue to watch a lot of screen time and they don't actually exercise the prefrontal cortex, then they won't grow and they'll have these problems lifelong. Yeah. So I think the number one factor is why we're having so much more is the screen time kids are getting. Second factor is the things we're doing to the immune system through processed everything, because the immune system impacts developing brain. I mentioned there's certain allergens that have been identified that can cause an ADHD-like symptomology. As we do things to cause overreactive immune systems, we can affect neurobiology and its development. We genetically modified foods have not been vetted on this question. There is evidence to suggest that there are significant problems related to that in our health because of the genetic modified foods. My personal belief is that this increase in gluten intolerance and celiac disease that you hear about so much that was really nothing like this when I grew up is not actually intolerance to gluten. They say it is. It's intolerance to genetically modified gluten. And if you take most of these individuals to Europe where they can eat things with gluten that has not been modified, the symptoms they don't have, and that autoimmune response that is causing that can affect brain attention concentration. It also can cause leaky gut. And in leaky gut, you get more inflammatory factors coming in the brain, and thus your cytokines kick up, and that can cause neurocognitive problems and attention-focused problems. And so I think there's a lot of variables in our society, particularly in our country today, with nutrition, with immune system, and then with screen times that are actually undermining healthy brain development.
And I have to ask the question that I guarantee there's a decent number of viewers that would wonder, you're a prescribing doctor, so I can ask you, is there actually overdiagnosing due to the sale of drugs? It's something you hear a lot. And so,
I don't know of any doctor today who is in any way incentivized to prescribe medications. In other words, they don't get more money if they prescribe or don't prescribe.
So
there's no reinforcing to the doctor who's the prescriber in our society today to prescribe meds to kids. They're not getting reinforced in that way, if that's the question.
Yeah.
No, the doctors don't make money off of the meds they're prescribing.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think another lot of questions is like, boys are typically diagnosed with ADHD more so than girls. And it's usually behavioral because they tend to be a little bit more outwardly behavioral and have behavioral conflicts that come up as they're growing into themselves. What do you kind of say to that?
I think that our society has misdiagnosed a lot of young men because they don't understand the normal physiologic development of young men. And they have taken young children and boys are different than girls, and they put them in an environment where they're to sit all day, and they have restricted recess and playtime, and little boys' bodies, more so than girls, but girls need it too, are very much wired at a certain age to develop the hunter-gatherer, to develop the eye-hand coordination, and they are wired to be active. They want to throw things. They want to catch things. They want to run, and they want to do this stuff. It's because they're going to be the hunter-gatherer and the women are going to be more they stay at home historically. So there's a wiring in element of development that little boys are going to be much more active, and it's going to be very hard for them to control this. That they're wired for this development. It's important, and so. When people have taken this into account and allowed lots of playtime, and then after playtime come in focus, the diagnosis is go way down. I think a lot of just normal development has been diagnosed as impulse control ADHD when it really isn't, and they medicate that. But that doesn't mean there isn't some as well. We hope this program has been helpful for you. If you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.